Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Venezuelan election results disputed. Low U.S. expectations of post-election Iran. And Taiwan president's rhetoric invites Chinese pressure. First, Venezuela's election results disputed. Two things were predictable about the Venezuelan presidential election. First, that President Nicolas Maduro would claim victory no matter what. He said he will win by hook or by crook. And second, that the opposition would declare victory based on polling. When the polls closed, the Election Commission, whose independence is suspect, declared Maduro the victor by 51-44%. Whereas all the exit polls by both U.S. and Venezuelan organizations showed that Edmundo González would win 65% of the vote to Maduro's 31% or less. There are reports that the opposition was unable to monitor the vote at polling stations, and the Maduro government prevented a plane carrying the ex-presidents of Mexico, Panama, Costa Rica, and Bolivia, all critics of the current Venezuelan government, from landing. They said they wanted to observe the election and were hoping for an opposition victory. Leaders from around the hemisphere generally reacted in disbelief. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. had, quote, serious concerns that the result announced does not represent the will or the votes of the Venezuelan people. Chile's President Gabriel Boric said, quote, Maduro's regime must understand that the results are hard to believe. The international community, and especially the Venezuelan people, including the millions of Venezuelans in exile, demand total transparency. From Chile, we will not recognize any result that is not verifiable. Bernardo Arevalo, president of Guatemala, agreed, quote, Venezuela deserves transparent, accurate results that adhere to the will of its people. We received the results announced by the Election Commission with many doubts. This is why electoral observation mission reports are essential, and today, more than ever, must defend Venezuelans' votes. Peru recalled its ambassador, its foreign minister saying, quote, I condemn in all extremity the sum of irregularities with the intention of fraud committed by the Venezuelan government. Peru will not accept the violation of the popular will of the Venezuelan people, unquote. The reactions of Brazil's and Colombia's leaders also were skeptical. Only the presidents of Cuba, Honduras, and Bolivia congratulated Maduro. What happens next is hard to predict. Maduro might enter into talks with the opposition or take the low road and try to suppress it. U.S. sanctions on the Maduro government, mainly on its oil exports, are likely to continue, at least as long as Biden is president. A Trump presidency will mean much harsher conditions and even more direct intervention to topple Maduro. A key factor is the reaction of the Venezuelan people. Will popular demonstrations go on, and will they be large enough and widespread enough to change the minds of the military leadership and overthrow Maduro? Low U.S. expectations for post-election Iran. The election of a new reform-minded president in Iran has not led to optimism in Washington about improving relations. Quote, We have no expectations that this election will lead to a fundamental change in Iran's direction or its policies, said State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller. At the end of the day, it's not the president that has the ultimate say over the future of Iran's policy. It is the supreme leader, and of course we have seen the direction that he has chosen to take Iran. Obviously, if the new president had the authority to make steps to curtail Iran's nuclear program, to stop funding terrorism, to stop destabilizing activities in the region, those would be steps that we would welcome. But needless to say, we don't have any expectations that that's what's likely to ensue, unquote. On top of that, Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the breakout time for Iran to produce a nuclear weapon is down to 1 to 2 weeks. He doesn't think it's possible to return to nuclear talks. That horse has left the barn, he's convinced. Yet another well-informed report from the Carnegie Endowment suggests that one reform President Pezeshkian will pursue is disengagement from Russia. Anti-Russian feeling in Iranian society is not likely to disappear anytime soon, writes Nikita Spagin, and Pezeshkian's victory should serve as a warning sign for the Kremlin. Cooperation with Tehran could become much harder in the future. He goes on to write, When it comes to foreign policy, this desire for change manifests itself as wanting to see an end to Iran's global isolation. In other words, the normalization of ties with the West. Pezeshkian spoke a lot about this during the election campaign, and like past reformers, openly called for better relations with Europe and dialing down tensions with the United States. What the Carnegie analysis and the U.S. State Department comments have in common is pessimism about prospects for policy shifts in Tehran. The State Department demands changes that Iran's supreme leader surely won't make. And the Carnegie Report argues that the one U.S. policy change that must precede closer relations with the West, reducing sanctions on Iran, is very unlikely to happen, given Israel-Iran tensions, Iran's nuclear program, and the upcoming U.S. election. Making the prospect of change even more remote is that Pezeshkian spoke with Vladimir Putin soon after the election and proposed that Iran and Russia sign a long-delayed strategic cooperation agreement. Taiwan president's rhetoric invites Chinese pressure. Starting with his inauguration speech, Taiwan President Lai Ching-te has emphasized Taiwan's sovereignty, a position guaranteed to anger Beijing, which claims the island nation as its own. Although Taiwan's previous leader, Tsai Ing-wen, also insisted that Taiwan be treated as a separate entity, she did not officially embrace the idea of Taiwan's sovereignty. She understood, as does the current president, that Beijing's red line for direct intervention is a Taiwan declaration of independence. President Lai has not spoken of declaring independence, but he has said that as a practical matter, quote, according to international law, we are already a sovereign and independent country. Such statements are enough to make him a target of official Chinese attacks, and more importantly, an escalation of harassing air and naval maneuvers near the island, to which Lai has responded with increased military preparedness. It's a dangerous situation at a time when President Biden and President Xi Jinping have tried to dampen tensions over Taiwan. Carefully managing the Taiwan issue may prove very difficult in a Trump administration. As Trump has demonstrated in the past, financial gain and vindictiveness are hallmarks of his approach to international relations, whether friends or adversaries. Recall that Trump entered office in 2017, believing that both Japan and China had ripped off the U.S. in trade relations, setting the stage for high tariffs on their exports. So, when he was asked in an interview with Bloomberg News on June 25 what his policy would be on Taiwan, his thoughts were not about defending the island, which Republicans in Congress consider the first priority, but this, quote, they, Taiwan, did take about 100% of our chip business. Taiwan should pay us for defense. You know, we're no different than an insurance company. Taiwan doesn't give us anything. Taiwan is 9,500 miles away. It's 68 miles away from China, unquote. Taiwan's advanced semiconductor industry is the great prize for China, Trump said. The apple of Xi's eye, Trump kept saying. Therefore, something they want to acquire without bombing. But Taiwan is too far away to defend, Trump seemed to say. He then repeated his upset. Now we're giving them billions of dollars to build new chips in our country, and then they're going to take that too. In other words, they'll build it, but then they'll bring it back to their country. These remarks don't go so far as to indicate that Trump would abandon Taiwan. He would face heavy Republican pressure to adhere at least to the traditional U.S. policy of strategic ambiguity, neither pledging to defend Taiwan nor pledging not to. Indeed, that was his administration's position in the first Trump administration. Still, his comments should prompt the new Taiwan administration to tread more cautiously when making statements about sovereignty that provoke a strong Chinese reaction. In other news, executive immunity and the CIA. Former intelligence officers writing in the Washington Post point out how the recent Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity could empower a president to use the CIA for missions once proscribed. As they write, quote, in practical terms, this means that a president may direct the CIA or a private paramilitary organization to engage in illegal activities. A president could also order the director of the CIA not to brief Congress on such activities, unquote. CIA actions that once required approval from congressional committees or the attorney general, such as the assassination of a foreign leader or surveillance of American citizens and foreign governments, could now require nothing more than a nod from the president. Even elimination of a political rival could be regarded as falling within the chief executive's official duties, just as Justice Sotomayor suggested in her dissent from the Supreme Court's decision. The two former CIA officials conclude, quote, "The Trump decision thus manages to turn the essence of the Nuremberg trials, that just following orders is not a defense to a war crime, on its head. It provides absolute immunity for the president, unqualified authority to pardon in advance underlings who follow illegal orders, and no legal accountability for obvious criminal activity." China's relations with Japan and India are not going well, but on the mend with Italy. At a critical point, that's the phrase used by China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi to describe relations with Japan in a meeting with his Japanese counterpart late last month. Differences in China-Japan relations have mounted recently. For Japan, they involve China's hold on fish imports from Japan due to concern about food safety since the Fukushima nuclear meltdown, and China's arrest of a Japanese business executive. China's issues with Japan include limits on semiconductor exports to China and long-running territorial disputes. Both countries have resumed high-level contacts, so the notion of a critical point may be exaggerated. But on the other hand, Japan's closer alignment with U.S., South Korean, and Philippines military plans spell containment to Chinese officials. Minister Wang also met with India's foreign minister. It is clear from the Chinese readout of the meeting that current relations are not satisfactory. Quote, "China and India, as two major neighboring developing countries and emerging economies, should step up dialogue and communication, increase understanding and mutual trust, properly handle differences, and develop mutually beneficial cooperation," unquote. As has been true for many years, conflict over their border is a primary reason for mistrust. India's foreign minister said, quote, "India and China have widely intertwined interests and are also facing the shadow brought by the border situation, but the Indian side is willing to find a solution to differences and bring bilateral relations back to the positive and constructive track. The two sides agreed to work together to maintain peace in the border areas and push for new progress in the consultation on border affairs," unquote. The two countries do have several avenues for working out differences on the border, but so far these pledges of mutual understanding have not produced agreement on where the border lies. On a better note for China, Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni visited Beijing at the end of July in an effort to repair the damage caused by Italy's decision in 2019 to withdraw from China's Belt and Road Initiative. The two countries agreed on an industrial collaboration memorandum that covers electric vehicles and renewable energy. Fiat will join with a Chinese company in producing an EV to market in Europe, and China pledges to open its markets to more Italian products. Finally, indigenous leaders in Latin America fight corporate colonialism. Multinational corporations have long been using a provision of U.S. trade agreements to sue host governments if they're not allowed to invest in projects on the lands of indigenous people. The trade provision, known as the Investor-State Dispute Settlement, gives corporations the right to sue if their quote-unquote investor rights are blocked by local laws, including those that protect indigenous people's property and environment. For example, the Honduran government is being sued for nearly $11 billion by a U.S. company that is being prevented by law from setting up a trade zone under its own rule. An indigenous community was successful at gaining repeal of the law that had originally allowed that zone. And in Ecuador, two indigenous communities had successfully challenged Chevron's oil pollution in the Amazon region. When Chevron used the investor-state dispute settlement system to countersue Ecuador, the country terminated all trade agreements with the U.S. that contained that provision. The action was then approved in a nationwide referendum. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.